This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm talking to Professor Tamsin Fall, Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Exeter Medical School. Tamsin will be speaking at the Emmanuel Miller Memorial Lecture and National Conference in March. The theme is attachment and early intervention, and Tamsin will be discussing why schools are an important setting in relation to child mental health. Hi Tamsin, welcome. Can you say a little about yourself by way of an introduction?
Yes, hello everyone. I trained as a doctor initially in London, and I did what would now be called core psychiatry training. So the first 3 years where you try different aspects of psychiatry out in the East End of London before moving to what was then the Bethlehem and Maudsley rotation to do my specialist training in child psychiatry. And I'm a little unusual in terms of a researcher in that I did all my clinical training up to the point where I could have been an NHS consultant before starting to do my research training and a PhD. But I think that is because my interests are very much on the applied side of research.
Can you say a little bit more about those interests and how that developed your line of practice?
Yes, well, as I was doing my training at the Bethlehem and Maudsley, of course, I was exposed to a great deal more research than I had been earlier in my career. And suddenly, research and its power to answer the difficult questions that we're faced with in clinical practice every day became very apparent to me. But It occurred to me that nobody seemed to be trying to answer the questions that I wanted answers to, which came down to, you know, why do certain young people struggle with their mental health in the face of certain stressors and others don't? And how do we keep young people well, prevent them from developing problems in the first place? And when people do develop problems, what are the best treatments for them?
Right. So there was nothing much going on. How far back are you going?
Well, I started my specialist training in 1995 and finished in early 1998 when I got involved in the first of the large national surveys as a clinical rater. So it was my job to look at the information that parents and young people and teachers had given to people who were interviewing them, and there were a mixture of very structured questions and some more detailed sort of own account words. And there were two of us who rated 10,500 children, and our job was to put the data together as we would in a clinic. So actually it was very, very clinical research, and the question we were answering for the government was how many children and young people out there have a clinical level of distress and difficulty in order to help planning services for them.
And what was the answer?
Well, the answer then was 1 in 10, and those children were followed up 3 years later. And then there was another survey in 2004, which also suggested about 1 in 10. Actually, a couple of weeks ago, 22nd of November, the next survey, 2017, the data were collected, were published, and it suggests that actually there has been a slight deterioration. So as opposed to just under 10%, it's now about 12, nearly 13% of 5 to 15-year-olds have that level of difficulty. And there are particular concerns about young women in their late teens, between 16 and 19, of whom nearly a quarter have that level of difficulty.
Gosh, that's a huge level of need. I understand that parents consult teachers more than any other service about their children's mental health. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And those data come from these big national surveys that I've just been talking about. So my PhD was from the first survey in 1999, and we looked forward. So we knew who had a psychiatric disorder or a clinical level of mental health difficulty at baseline, and then we tracked who got to services and which services over the next 3 years. And what we showed is only about a quarter of those who had a clinical level of distress and difficulty at baseline were seen in mental health services over the next 3 years. But actually, teachers were the most commonly consulted professional, and almost as many as in mental health services were supported by specialist educational professionals. So educational welfare officers, educational psychologists, behavioural support teachers are doing an awful lot of mental health work. So our schools are essentially default mental health services.
Right. Can I go back to that figure you mentioned earlier about 16 to 19-year-olds?
Yeah.
Why has that deteriorated, and why is that particular group? I mean, it's probably quite a huge question, really, but why do you think that group is so vulnerable?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. So the first survey focused on 5 to 15-year-olds, and so we can only look at the trends in 5 to 15-year-olds, and there is this slight increase, and it does seem to be almost completely explained by an increase in emotional disorders, and particularly in older children, although in this age group, the same pattern is evident in boys as in girls. So there is something that's happening in the older teens, but sadly, this is the first survey we've done where we've included 16 to 19-year-olds. So we have no direct comparable data, but what I can say is we are getting a consistent signal on this. So there were similar findings using a questionnaire called the Moods and Feelings Questionnaire from the Millennium Cohort study when they got to sort of 14. And the Adult Mental Health Survey, and that's been done much more regularly every 5 years since the sort of late 1990s, that also showed very high rates of emotional disorder, so anxiety and depression, among young women aged 16 to 25. So I don't think we have evidence what's causing it, and I certainly don't want to speculate, but I think we've got fairly convincing evidence from different sources that this is a consistent signal. We need to worry about our young women.
Right. Just taking a step back, can you say what the Incredible Years teacher program is? What is teacher classroom management? Just to go back a bit and actually explain what it entails.
Yes, this is part of a set of three programs which were developed by Carolyn Webster Stratton, who's based in Seattle, that were aimed to improve the behaviour of children with really quite severe behaviour problems of the type that's impeding their ability to access schools and for their families to look after them. Mm-hmm. And it involves a parent programme, it involves a programme for the young people, and then a teacher programme. And the idea was that you got everybody using the best evidence from well-tried and tested psychological theories. So it drew on basic principles of reinforcement so that you get behaviour repeated if you pay attention to it. So therefore you need to catch kids being good and not sweat the small stuff, to speak colloquially. A lot of, you know, is leave as a lot of the minor stuff, ignore it if you possibly can. Obviously there's some you can't. But balance that with being very clear about what you want, praising and encouraging the child for doing what you want, and being very clear about what will happen if they do something that they're not supposed to. So lots of, if you do this, then this will happen. And until my trial started, there hadn't been a big trial of the teacher program on its own. There had been with the parenting program, which has been disseminated far and wide. And it makes sense. If you can only train one person, then starting with the parents is the best thing to do. But it occurred to me from my clinical work, you see quite a lot of families who are not back when things get difficult at school. And it's common sense that no amount of parent training is going to impact a behavioural problem that's manifest in the school situation, because it's not the parent that has the control in that situation. So I wondered if we took out the teacher program and just tried it on its own, whether we could get a detectable impact on children's mental health.
Right. Why are schools then such an important setting to consider when it comes to child mental health? I'm assuming it's to do with the length of time that children are actually in school. They spend an awful lot of their early years in schools.
Well, yes, they spend a lot of time there. And, you know, in our society, children, compulsory school age is, you know, the bulk of the children's life after the family is the school. But also, it's a setting in which life chances are determined, in which you develop your social skills, and you learn about your place in the world. And as with occupations in adulthood, if you are not able to function, it's pretty disastrous. But what's worse for children is that it's not that you can't function for, you know, 3 months, 6 months, a year, and then you pick up where you were. You are now behind your peers who've all moved forward. Right. So you can get problems that just stack. And some of the more neurodevelopmental child mental health conditions actually make the school environment incredibly difficult to cope with. So I'm thinking about autism spectrum conditions and ADHD here. And obviously, behaviour problems are a massive interest in schools. And actually, until this most recent survey, severe behavioural problems were the commonest childhood mental health problem. And if you listen to teachers, a phenomenal number, it's something like a third of teachers have left the profession within 5 years of beginning their training. And what they complain about as a major source of stress is behaviour and struggling to manage it. And yet classroom management does not figure highly in the formal training that they get. And even less so as we move to kind of accelerated training programmes where you're learning on the job, so you fall back on your own experience, both in school and at home, and what you see around you. And if both of those were good, you're probably fine. But that's not the situation that everyone was in.
So STARS stands for the Supporting Teachers and Children in Schools Trial, is that correct?
That's correct. And
when was it set up?
It started in 2012. That's when we first got funding. And because you are very constrained by the school year, we couldn't get round all 80 schools in 1 year. So we had overlapping cohorts. So we had 15 schools come in the first year, then 30, and then 35. So we kind of ramped up. And we've each trial, our school stayed in the trial for nearly three academic years. So we finished our data collection in April of 2017, and we're busy writing up and analysing the results still.
Right, okay. And what are the sort of interim findings that you can talk about at this stage, apart from the ones you've already told me? Are there any other insights that you can share?
Well, we've had a sort of first look at our qualitative data. And as I say, it's very powerful. The teachers really valued this. They found it hugely helpful, and they do think it's having an impact on the children, but also on themselves. We picked up some effects on the children. We didn't pick up any effects on the questionnaires on the teachers. We tried to get at how the children were learning by using the national curriculum levels that teachers at the beginning of the trial had to fill in on every child. But it was slightly complicated and messy because it didn't apply to the very young children, you know, the four-year-olds in reception. And it changed several times because, it, you know, it was coming from government, so they kept amending it over the course of the trial. And then more recently, they've told schools they didn't have to do it. So it was very crude and very messy. And it won't surprise anybody that we didn't detect an effect on learning overall. But again, there's a hint that something is going on if you divide the sample by those who are struggling and those are not, who are not. So right. What we think might be happening is if you settle the class down, the children who are in good mental health, their learning accelerates. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the data's confusing and not very powerful and not very well measured, but it's enough to interest an education funder in funding a replication where actually academic outcomes are going to be the main focus. But they are also going to get at this issue of teacher-pupil relationships, because that's what the teachers are telling us really changed and really improved, and that's what they think is driving the benefit.
So how might the Incredible Years programme be expanded?
Well, that's interesting. I can see a number of ways it could be used. When I first was trying to study it, I spent a lot of time talking to our Graduate School of Education at Exeter about was there some way that we could get it into basic teacher training. And I do wonder if, you know, whilst teachers are off doing their school practice, particularly in the accelerated training programs there are now, where they do much more direct work and they're out in classrooms more quickly, whether or not it could be incorporated, or perhaps in the newly qualified teacher year. I mean, ideally, I think you need a whole school approach, of which training along this line would really help. You know, we didn't really expect to change school cultures by training a single teacher. And in fact, one of the things that our teachers commonly complain about is, you know, they're busy ignoring John is, you know, fiddling around, knowing yeah. that he'll stop if they don't pay attention to it. And the TA steps in and tells him off because that's what they think they should do. And, you know, teaching assistants are only paid to be in the classroom during teaching hours. It's quite difficult to explain to them what you're doing and why you're doing it. Sometimes the policy in some schools, particularly with a very sort of, you know, a very literal understanding of zero tolerance. You know, sometimes senior management team were saying, well, you can't ignore stuff because that's against zero tolerance. I'm not sure it necessarily is. You know, so a one lone teacher is not going to change a culture in many schools. But we did have one where the teacher who came on the course had a particularly challenging class. She was so blown away by the impact. But also was the head of Key Stage 1 that she rewrote her behaviour policy. Every new member of staff was given a copy of the book that goes with it, and she sat there with them going through it to make sure that they read it. And then Key Stage 2 saw a class that had been very problematic and had a bad reputation settle down and start attaining really well, and thought, we'll have some of that. So actually in this particular school, it's only anecdote, but training that one teacher had a massive effect. But I think realistically, you would need to train everybody in the school. And that wouldn't just be the teaching staff. It would be the dinner ladies, the playground assistants, you know, so that everybody is handling the children in the same way.
Are you optimistic that that will happen?
Well, I think it depends what the replication shows. So we have got a hint that this might improve mental health overall, that it might be most effective for those who are struggling. And I should say that the two trials in Northern America found the same thing. So this seems to be a consistent signal. And given the devastation that poor mental health can wreak on somebody's development and their life chances, I think that's worth having for not actually a huge amount of money. But I think it will depend what this second trial shows. So we'll know in about 2 or 3 years' time.
Okay, I'll have to come back to you then. To check, what was the age group in Incredible Years programme and also in the trial? What age group were you focusing on?
Well, the Incredible Years programmes are recommended. There's a baby version, a toddler version, and certainly sort of up to about age 11 now, so very much primary school age. Our trial was unusual in that we recruited children between the ages of 4 and 9, because there is this belief, and it is just a belief, because there's very little empirical data that the program is more effective with very young children. And it may well be true. It's just that the belief is so prevalent that nobody's actually done it.
Right.
I'm not sure we had sufficient people to see whether age did make a difference. We could only look broadly. Key stage one, which is age sort of 4 to 7 versus key stage two, which was sort of 7 to 9. And we didn't really see anything. But yes, it's for younger children.
Right. I get that the emphasis is on early intervention, but given the figures you gave to me earlier about 16 to 19 year olds, is there a place for something similar in secondary schools?
Well, yes, I think you could use many of the same principles, but they would need to be adapted. You know, teenagers probably wouldn't respond terribly well to stickers and to, you know, some of the explicit techniques. Certainly, I have a colleague in Bangor, Judy Hutchins, who has done a lot of work with all of the Incredible Years programs. And these have been implemented much more extensively in Wales than they've virtually not been used in England in schools. But she has had people come along from secondary and to attend the course, who then, you know, need to tweak quite how they do it. I guess we need to be absolutely sure it's having a worthwhile impact in the younger children before we start fiddling around too much in the older children. And there are some other things, for example, restorative justice approaches and things which seem to be having an impact on well-being and levels of bullying at secondary school level.
So there's a lot going on. It's just a matter of waiting for the data to be available. In December 2017, the government published its green paper, Transforming Children and Young People's Mental Health Provision. And this set out proposals to create a network of support for children, including establishing designated mental health leads in schools. What opportunities do you feel might arise from the green paper?
Well, it's really welcome to see the focus in schools, and we absolutely need to do something. Firstly, because the staff working in schools needs training and support to deal with this role that's often thrust upon them, and because when they are trying to teach children who have poor mental health, they can't do their primary job as educators. But also because there simply is never going to be four times the current investment in child and adolescent mental health services. It would be lovely, but I'm not holding my breath for that to happen. And yet, you know, CAMHS services are, you know, really struggling to keep up with the workload that they are delivering, and it's about a quarter of those who have clinically impairing problems. And of course, for every one of those who have clinically impairing problems, there are others who don't quite meet that cut point, but probably could benefit and would respond to some of the interventions we have. And we should be, proud of the therapeutic options we have. We do have both psychological and drug treatments that can help people get through these problems and you know, back onto a more ordinary developmental trajectory. So I think broadly I welcome the focus, but I think many of us are a bit frustrated by the level of ambition. So sort of getting it out to a third of schools in several years' time is just not good enough for those areas that it won't get to. It will take considerable resource. It's going to need careful thought in terms of who you train up as the designated mental health leads and what access they have. Because identifying people who have difficulties is not helpful unless you can offer them something, which right. I think has been a lot of the problem to date. And again, the idea of having some school-based mental health teams who are on site, so you're not taking children who may be struggling at school out of school to go to appointments, all of that's good. But it's going to need to be sufficiently resourced. And I think there may be issues for child mental health services when these services first get going, because they will identify a lot of people out there who are currently struggling, who are not accessing services. So it may actually massively increase demand.
Right.
And we need to be careful how we handle the expectations. But it is good to see a school-based workforce. It's good to see the interest in children's mental health in schools, and it's good to support teachers and other people who work in schools to get sound information about children's mental health.
What sort of role will CAMHS play, do you think, in once those proposals are brought to fruition, assuming that they are?
Well, I think the Green Paper is deliberately being giving people leeway to work to their normal context. I mean, I think CAMHS will need to work very carefully and closely with the school mental health teams to back them up, to support and train people within them, and to make sure that they avoid duplication but also gaps in service. There's no point having, you know, two services that deal with children with anxiety and nothing for those with autism, for example, to pick a crude example.
I'm also curious about how these designated mental health leads will be identified as the appropriate person. How do you envisage that working?
Well, again, there's not a lot of detail in the Green Paper, and I suspect it will come down, as many of these things due to, a kind of mixture of who's available, who's interested, and who's got time and capacity. Schools are very, very busy places. And I think it's really important that we offer people high quality evidence-based training and support in these roles, and that we need to train more than one person in a school, because there's quite a lot of turnover. And if you only have one person and they go, then you don't have anyone.
Right. And of course, there are cost and resource implications to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that level of detail has been worked out. But I think it's partly because the Joint Health and Education Select Committee and those who wrote the Green Paper are encouraging, let's look at a different ways of doing this in different contexts to get a series of models rather than dictating from the centre how it should be.
And is that the right approach, in your view?
Well, I certainly have sympathy for the fact that it's very unlikely that those at the centre will know all the nuance. And I think different areas are very different in terms of the services they have and what the relationships are like between agencies, which is largely historical. So I think my main worry is about the lack of resources and the lack of ambition to get this work out across the country, although I have to say I'm glad that they are piloting it. But I think a degree of standardisation and careful measurement is needed to make sure that the resources that are available aren't wasted.
Mm-hmm. If the proposals don't go ahead, what would be the long-term, both the financial and the human cost of not implementing these proposals?
Well, I think the important thing is, and it's not entirely clear to me whether this is the case, if money is diverted away from trained practitioners within CAMHS services to set up smaller, less tried models of working, that may not be a good thing. But if we can expand by developing lower level practitioners who deal with the routine cases with the minimum disruption in school, you know, that I think could have a sizable impact on children and young people's mental health. There is clearly something going on at the moment that does seem to be impacting the mental health of young people, particularly young women in their teens. Mm-hmm. Now, we could hypothesize about what that's likely to be. It's more likely to be sort of social and psychological than anything biological, most of us think. But I don't think it's going away anytime soon. And the implication of deteriorating mental health in our young people is that we're going to need more, not less, mental health prevention, treatment, and mental health promotion. And if we don't get it, then we will have an adult workforce that's not able to function very well. And for those that are parents, parental mental health is very correlated with child mental health. So there may be impacts into the next generation.
Right. So there's a huge amount at stake.
Yeah.
Are there any new developments in the pipeline, both in terms of research, any particular pilot schemes that you'd like to mention?
Well, I think there is a huge interest amongst funders on in young people's mental health, and particularly anxiety and depression in emerging adults and older teenagers. And that's, you know, responding to what all these surveys are showing, and that's great. And it's really good to see, but I think it's going to need to be sustained to have any effect. So there's a lot of activity, a lot of it of very high quality. And I think the next decade or so is going to be an exciting time to be a mental health researcher.
When do you think there'll be some key results? I mean,
Well, I think we're already beginning to see them. So I think research is not a fast process. And I think there's a big spectrum from innovations with, you know, quick and dirty service evaluations, because that's all you can do, to something like the STARS trial, which was sort of 5 years in the planning and the feasibility, and then another 5 years to execute. And then the answer we get is, well, this might have an impact, but we need to do it bigger and better. So there'll be some things that take a long time to discover, and other things about, you know, what's placing people at risk, what's impacting on mental health, that may be quicker because we can use data that's already around and we don't have to go out and get it.
Right. And will you be making the STARS trial bigger and better?
Well, there is STARS 2, as it were. We'll start recruiting schools in January. So, yes, it's already funded. And it will train more teachers in a school and follow children for 2 years rather than 1 year. So those in the intervention arm will be exposed to teachers who are trained over 2 years. And there will be this focus on teacher-pupil relationships as well as the academic and mental health outcomes.
Right. That's really exciting. You're presenting at the National Conference in March. Can you give a brief summary of some of the areas that you plan to cover?
Well, I will talk a little bit about STARS, but also the other work that I've done around schools that demonstrates the overlap between being able to cope at school and having poor mental health. So I've done a body of work on attendance at school and mental health, which is in process at the moment with Katie Finning, who is a PhD student of mine. And I've also done some work on teacher-pupil relationships and their impact on children's mental health, and exclusion from school, which was another PhD student of mine, Claire Parker. So we have data from large national surveys, which teases apart the impact of mental health on children's ability to function on school, but also the school experience on children's mental health.
Can you say anything about the findings on those? For example, the pupil-teacher relationship research?
They're Without, you know, giving the whole lecture, we did, our findings suggest that there was an impact of teacher-pupil relationships if they were poor on children's mental health, even amongst those who were doing fine at baseline, and particularly related to behaviour problems, which of course is the mental health condition that teachers really don't want to have to deal with, and that in primary school children it impacts on families' ability to function, and this is impact over time, not cross-sectional, and in secondary school students it seems to impact on exclusion. So very important.
And presumably it impacts on the rest of the class as well.
That we didn't measure. In some cases, yes. You know, there is a very interesting paper by Tish Jennings and Mark Greenberg where they describe the burnout cascade in teachers, that you get a cycle of a teacher who is stressed and burnt out and doesn't feel able to do their job. So they're irritable, they're not good at handling the children, who then become more increasingly unsettled and badly behaved, so the teacher's more stressed and burnt out, and you get into a very vicious circle. And part of what we were hoping the Incredible Years course would do for teachers is to reverse that and get into a virtuous circle, so that, you know, the teacher was aware of the children who struggled and what they struggled with and handled them proactively rather than waiting for things to go wrong. Therefore, the whole class is more settled and the teacher feels calmer and more able to do their job. And then you get into a virtuous cycle and everybody is happier and more settled and can actually get on with the primary job of schools, which is to educate people.
But how widespread is the Incredible Years teacher programme?
Well, there have been some recent trials of it. I think it's quite widely disseminated in New Zealand. It's barely used in this country. We had to fly people over from Seattle to train them in order to deliver the trial, because the nearest person was in Bangor, and that's too far away from Devon. So, you know, in our country, it's really not very widely disseminated at all. The parenting program is everywhere, and rightly so.
Okay. So there's room for expansion on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've covered a huge amount. Is there anything you want to add that I haven't asked?
I don't think so. Thank you.
Okay. And do you have a take-home message for people listening to this podcast? Do you have a take-home message for listeners of this podcast?
I think just to be very aware, whether or not you work in education or you work in mental health, that the reciprocal relationship between mental health and education is hugely important. And, you know, you can't be a good mental health practitioner if you're not thinking about what's going on at school. And you can't be a good, successful educator if you're not also thinking about mental health, and that we ought to work much more closely than we do. And that's why I think the Green Paper is really good to see the focus on school-based mental health.
Tamsin, thank you ever so much. Professor Tamsin Ford will be speaking at the Emmanuel Miller Memorial Lecture and National Conference, which focuses on attachment and early intervention, improving emotional well-being and relationships in the family and at school. The conference takes place on March the 8th at the Royal College of Physicians in London. You can find details on the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and on Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled ACAMH.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.